Life of Caliph Ali by Abul Hasan Ali Nadwi. Chapter 1. Ali bin Abu Talib in Makkah. Family characteristics. Anatomy, sociology, ethics are all agreed that every man has certain inherited traits in his blood which have a role in shaping his character, aptitude, competence, inclinations, and frame of mind. These traits are in the following forms. First, the beliefs and values held strictly, cherished and revered by a family get built into the minds of the people belonging to the family, and anyone disregarding them is considered as a rebel and is not tolerated by others. Second, what one hears repeatedly from childhood, as for example about courage, bravery, magnanimity and generosity, charity, truthfulness and honesty, gets ingrained in one's mind and shapes the bent of mind. They determine the inclinations and dispositions and give a measure for judgment of these moral values. Thirdly, inherited traits are also generally visible in the stature, appearance, particularly in those families which endeavor to preserve their purity of blood. Inherited traits have also been described by the Prophet in an eloquent manner, a mode of expression that is peculiar to the Prophets alone. He expressed the kernel of the matter in the most convincing way. Abu Huraira relates from the Prophet, quote, "People are minds like those of gold and silver. Those among them who are distinguished in the days of Jahiliyyah, that means ignorance, will be outstanding after entering the folds of Islam." The Prophet also said, "Anyone kept back by his deeds will not be taken ahead by his lineage." End quote. It does not mean that any family deserves respect solely by the virtue of its blood or lineage, nor religious, spiritual, or intellectual leadership is an inalienable right by parentage. The world had, in pre-Islamic days, seen the worst type of social and moral anarchy because of genealogical chauvinism, for often it was cruelly exploited by dictators claiming divine right on kingship and priesthood. The Romans, the Iranians, and the Indian civilizations furnish many examples, some of which will be dealt with in greater detail in the subsequent chapters. It is therefore our duty to reflect on the customs and traditions of the family in which Ali bin Abu Talib was born and brought up, and assess with complete impartiality his family characteristics, moral and psychological factors that influenced its younger generations, and what regard his family enjoyed amongst the Arab tribes. We shall have to first look at the tribe of Quraysh and then at Banu Hashim for that. The tribe of Quraysh. The people of Arabia were unanimous about the nobility of the Quraysh, and none had ever disputed their superiority amongst the Arabs. Their language, their dictation, were taken as models by other tribes. Hospitality, bravery, and courage were their distinguishing qualities. Anyone possessing these characteristics was compared with the Quraysh. For example, anyone exceptionally eloquent or cordial to his guests was deemed to have Quraishite traits. The different clans of Quraysh were allied to one another. They cherished these tribal characteristics and strictly followed what they considered to be moral and social code, which was handed down by Abraham. They were singularly different from the Bedouins, that is, the dwellers of the desert, who were neither strict in adherence to their religion nor possessed any distinctive culture. Other distinguishing characteristic of the Quraysh consisted of affection to their children, which is a quality which was lacked by the Bedouins. The circumambulation of the Kaaba and performing the rites of Hajj, enshrouding the dead bodies and taking a bath after coitus. Unlike the Brahmins of India and the Majus of Iran, they never had any priestly class. They preferred marriage ties amongst distinct kins. They solemnized marriage in the presence of witnesses and fixed a dowry. They pronounced divorce 3 times, and they never married their daughters or the daughters' daughters, sisters or the sisters' daughters, like the Magis of Iran. They deemed such relationships as shameful. The Quran has set the seal on these convictions of the Quraysh by incorporating them in the Islamic Sharia. Any honor enjoyed by the Quraysh was that its members were entitled to marry in any tribe, but they did so only when the lady whom anyone married was a firm believer in their religion. The Quraysh held the view that it was improper and against their traditions to establish conjugal relationships with anyone not subscribing to their faith or lacking the zeal for it. Banu Hashim. Banu Hashim were regarded as the gentry among the Quraysh, that is, the highest among the Quraysh. Historical accounts have little to offer in this connection, yet whatever little details are available go to show that the members of Banu Hashim were known for their moderation and practical approach. Possessing religious ardor and soundness of judgment, they were zealous supporters of the veneration of the Kaaba as the house of God. They disliked cruelty and oppression and obstinacy, cherished enterprise and ambition, admired kindness, and were beneficent to the poor and the weak. In short, in their manner and morals, they combine the qualities that are best described in what we call as chivalrous. With these attributes, the Banu Hashim were preeminently suited to become the progeny of the Holy Prophet. Some of these ethical norms were taken over and propagated by Islam. It is, however, a different matter that they had, like other tribes of Arabia, joined their faith to the prevailing paganism of the pre-Islamic Arabia, which was rejected by Islam. Abdul Talib bin Hashim. Following his uncle Al-Muttalib, Abdul Muttalib took over the duties of As-Saqaya and Ar-Rifada of the pilgrims and discharged these obligations to the satisfaction of his people. He attained such eminence as none of his forefathers had enjoyed. He won the love and respect for all. Abdul Muttalib was not rich like his grandfather Qusay, nor was the sole authority over the Quraysh. A number of rich and influential people were there in Mecca, but he was regarded as one of the dignitaries by virtue of his responsibilities of watering and feeding the pilgrims. He carried out these duties with sincerity and devotion. He had also the charge of the well of Zamzam, which, because of its age-old association with the Kaaba, had enhanced his honor and prestige. Abdul Muttalib's veneration of the Kaaba and his conviction that it was the house of God who would defend it, demonstrated by the talk that he had with Abraha. The incident also exhibits the dignified and disposition of the Qurayshite leader. When Abraha invaded Makkah for the destruction of the Kaaba, and Abraha's troops took away 200 camels of Abdul Muttalib, he went to the camp and sought permission to see Abraha. The Abyssinian ruler treated him with greatest respect, got off his throne, and made Abdul Muttalib sit beside him on the carpet. He inquired what Abdul Muttalib wanted. Thereupon, Abdul Muttalib replied that he wanted Abraha to return his 200 camels, which had been captured by his men. Abraha looked surprised at Abdul Muttalib and said, "Do you wish to talk to me about 200 camels of yours which I have taken, and say nothing about your religion and the religion of your forefathers which I have come to destroy today?" Abdul Muttalib replied, "I am the owner of the camels, and the sanctuary has an owner who will defend it." When Abraha rejoined that, and he could not defend it against him, Abdul Muttalib said, "This is a matter between you and God." Abdul Muttalib used to warn his sons against being oppressive. He did not allow them to be mean or indecent and commanded moral virtues. He died when he was 80 years of age, and his grandson, the Prophet, was of 8 years of age. He would have thus died in 578 AD. Historians were on record that after his death, the market of Makkah remained closed for several days as a mark of respect for him. Abu Talib. Abu Talib bin Abdul Muttalib was 35 years elder to the Prophet. His name is reported by some chroniclers of the time as Imran and Shaiba, though the reports commonly accepted give it as Abdul Munaf. However, he later came to be known as the Kunya Abu Talib. He was one of the chieftains of Quraysh who acted as arbiter in the disputes amongst the people and was consulted by others in important matters. Abdul Muttalib had, before his death, entrusted the grandson by Abdullah to the care of Abu Talib, who took over his nephew under his guardianship. Abu Talib had loving respect and regard for his nephew, that is the Prophet, and took keen interest in his welfare. The Apostle of God was still young when Abu Talib took him to Syria with a merchant caravan. Abu Talib and the Prophet's father, Abdullah, were brothers by the same mother, Fatima bin Amr bin Ayd bin Imran bin Makhzum. Abu Talib was a man of modest means, but he was attached to his nephew, that is the Prophet, more than his own sons. He made the child sleep with him and took him wherever he went. He felt so closely attached to the Prophet as if he had never been to anyone else. Abu Talib gave him preference over others in food. Ibn Ishaq relates that it was Abu Talib who used to look after the Prophet after the death of his grandfather and became one of his family. Abu Talib always favored the Prophet and stood by him. Abu Talib once planned to go with a merchant caravan to Syria, and when all the preparations were made for the journey, the Prophet felt sad for separation from his uncle. Abu Talib could not bear the sight and said, "By God, neither this child can part company with me nor I can leave him. I will take him with me on the journey." The Prophet used to say about his aunt Fatima bin Asad, the wife of Abu Talib, "After the death of my mother who had given birth to me, Fatima bin Asad was my mother. Whenever Abu Talib invited others to have lunch, he made me share it, and she would keep something apart for me which was taken by me later on." Fatima bint Asad says Abu Amr was the first Hashemite lady who gave birth to another Hashemite. Fatima bint Asad embraced Islam and also migrated to Medina. When she died, the Prophet shrouded her with his own shirt, and as a mark of respect for her, himself lay her down in her grave before lowering her in it. When the Prophet of God started preaching Islam and speaking disparagingly of the idols and idolatry and declaring paganism as unfounded and false, the people of Makkah took great offense and resolved unanimously to oppose him as their enemy. Abu Talib, however, continued to protect and support the Prophet. The animosity between the Prophet and the people of Makkah deepened, and at last some of their leading men went to Abu Talib and said, "You have a high and lofty position amongst us. We have asked you to prohibit your son from his teachings, but you have not done so. By God, we cannot endure that our forefathers should be insulted or mocked and our gods be insulted. Now, you either put a stop to his activities or we shall fight you both until one of us dies." Abu Talib told the Prophet what the people had said to him and asked the Prophet to spare him and his own self. The reply given by the Prophet was, quote, "O my uncle, if they put sun in my right hand and the moon in my left hand and my left on the condition that I abandon this course, I would not forsake it until God has made it victorious or I perish therein." Thereafter, Abu Talib said to the Prophet, "My nephew, continue your mission and say what you please, for by God, I will never give you up on any account." When Islam began to spread amongst other tribes, the Quraysh came together and decided themselves to write a document in which they decided to boycott Banu Hashim and Banu Muttalib, that they would not marry their women, and that they would not buy or sell to them. The document was hung inside the Kaaba, and everybody abided by it. The two clans of Banu Hashim and Banu Talib stood by Abu Mutalib and entered with him in the alley. It was the seventh year of the Prophet's mission when the boycott was decided upon. For 3 years, Banu Hashim remained confined in the alley, nothing reaching them except what their sympathizers gave them in secret. They endured great tribulation until worms ate up the document and the covenant was automatically ended. In mid-Shawwal of the 10th year of the Prophet's mission, Abu Talib breathed his last. He was then 86 years of age. It was the year when the Prophet's wife Khadija also died. Abu Talib did not embrace Islam. The Prophet had to face during the year many trials that followed fast after one another. The Prophet called it the year of sorrows. The sons of Abu Talib. Abu Talib had 4 sons: Talib, on account in which he is known as Abu Talib; Aqil, Jafar bin Abu Talib; and Ali bin Abu Talib. He had 2 daughters, Hani and Jumana. All 6 of them were born to Fatima bint Asad, 10 years between each of them. Thus Ali was 10 years younger to Jafar. Talib died as a polytheist, that is, a mushrik, sometime after the Battle of Badr. It had been related that he had gone out on a journey, but he never returned, leaving no trace of him. He had gone along with some others who had lost their way in the journey. He had a great affection for the Prophet and also had composed some verses praising the Prophet. At the time of Battle of Badr was fought, he accompanied the Quraysh, though disinclined. When the Qurayshite set to fight the Muslims, they taunted Talib, saying, "O Hashimites, we know that you have accompanied us reluctantly, for your sympathies are with Muhammad." At Badr, Talib did not fight the Muslims and returned to Makkah. He composed a few verses and odes eulogizing the Prophet and a poem lamenting those who had been killed at Badr. Aqil was the second son of Abu Talib, who was known as Abu Yazid. He embraced Islam at the time of the conquest of Makkah, while others claim that he entered the fold of Islam after the Treaty of Hudaybiyah and migrated to Medina in the 8th year after Hijri. He had been one of the captives of Badr, for whom ransom was paid by Abbas. His name finds a mention in several hadiths. He participated in the Battle of Mu'tah, but nothing is reported about him in connection with the conquest of Makkah and the expedition to Hunain. Perhaps because he was not keeping well on these occasions, as stated by Abu Sa'd, but Abu Zubair ibn Bakkar has related on the authority of Hussein bin Ali that he was one of those companions who remained unshaken in the Battle of Hunain. Abu Talib was more attached to Aqil than to any of his sons. When during the grievous famine, the Prophet and Abbas had approached Abu Talib with the suggestion that they were prepared to relieve his burden by taking over the responsibility of maintaining his sons, he had replied, Do as you like as long as you leave me with Aqil." The Prophet of God took charge of Ali bin Abu Talib and Abbas of Jafar bin Abu Talib. Aqil bin Abu Talib was an expert in genealogy and character of Quraysh. People used to call upon him in the Masjid al-Nabawi, Medina, to inquire about the pedigree of different people. He was very witty and could easily reduce anyone to silence. Hisham al-Qalabi relates from Abdullah bin Abbas that Quraysh used to refer their cases for arbitration to one of the 4 people: Aqil, Makhrama, Huayb, and Abu Jaham. Ibn Sa'd says that Aqil bin Abu Talib died during the reign of Khalifa Muawiyah, while Tariq al-Bukhari al-Askhar contains a report with complete chain of narrations and narrators which affirm that he died during the reign of Yazid before the incident of Harra. He was 96 years of age at the time of his death and he had lost his eyesight. He had a large family. Out of his 12 sons, 9 had accompanied Hussein ibn Ali and all of them laid down their lives with him. Muslim bin Aqil was the bravest of all, who had been sent to Kufa by Hussein, where he had been mercilessly slain by Yazid. Ja'far bin Abu Talib was one of the earliest converts to Islam when the Brotherhood was instituted amongst the Muhajirin and the Ansar. Write historians, the Prophet made Ja'far the brother of Mu'az bin Jabal. Abu Huraira says that Ja'far bin Abu Talib was the most meritorious after the Prophet. Bukhari describes him as the most magnanimous to the poor. Khalid al-Hazza relates from Ikramah that Abu Huraira heard the Prophet saying that of all men who walked on earth and rode on horses, Ja'far bin Abu Talib was the most excellent. His report by Abu Huraira also finds place with complete chain of narrations in Tirmidhi and Nasai. Baghwi has reported on the authority of Muqbiri that Abu Huraira said, Ja'far had an affectionate regard for the poor. He used to sit down and mix with them and used to serve them selflessly. The Prophet of God used to call him Abul Masakin, or the father of the poor. The Prophet also said to Ja'far once, you resemble me both in features and in character. Ja'far migrated to Abyssinia, where Najashi, Negus, and his men accepted Islam on his hand. He returned shortly after the conquest of Khaybar. The Prophet gave him a warm welcome and kissed his forehead and said, I can't say whether I am pleased more by Ja'far's return or the conquest of Khaybar. Abdullah bin Ja'far says that whenever he asked anything from Ali and Ali refused, he sought it again in the name of Ja'far and Ali always granted his request. Ja'far bin Abu Talib died fighting in the battlefield of Mu'ta in Jumada, 8th Hijri, during the lifetime of the Prophet. He charged the enemy riding with a horse. After the battle hemmed, he jumped off his charger, hamstrung the horse, and fight till he was killed. Ibn Amr says that he was one of those who fight in the Battle of Mu'ta. When his comrades searched for the bodies of the martyrs, the dead body of Ja'far was found with more than 90 cuts on the front made by arrows. The Prophet said that he had seen Ja'far flying with the angels in paradise. Tabrani has recorded this report on the authority of Ibn Abbas. Another version of the report says the Prophet saw Ja'far as an angel whose both arms were bloodstained since they had been cut in the battle. When the troops returned from Mu'ta to Medina, the Prophet and other Muslims received them outside the city. A number of children had come out. The Prophet, who was riding his camel, told the people to take the children up and asked to give him the son of Ja'far. Abdullah bin Ja'far was brought to him and seated on the lap of the Prophet. Aisha relates that when the news of Ja'far's death was received by the Prophet, sorrow was seen on his face. The Prophet said to the members of the family of Ja'far, bring the children of my brother. They were brought to him and he felt as they were chickens. He sent for the barber and got a haircut. The Prophet said to the mother, you must be anxious about their maintenance and upkeep. I am their guardian in this world and I am their guardian in the next world. Others have reported that the Prophet asked Ja'far's wife to bring her children. When they were brought to him, the Prophet smelt them and his eyes were filled with tears. It has been related that the news of Ja'far's death came. The Prophet said to the family members, provide food to Ja'far's family, for they have received news which will not allow them to do anything. His face clearly shows signs of sorrow. Abdullah, the son of Ja'far, also was the first child born to a Muslim couple when his parents were in Abyssinia. He was known for his benevolence and generosity. Two other sons of Ja'far were Muhammad and Aun. Negus had asked the Muslim migrants what was the religion for which they had forsaken their people without entering into their religion or any other. Ja'far bin Abu Talib then rose to give a reply and he depicted an exact picture of the Arabian society during their days of ignorance. He then described the revolutionary change Islam had brought into the lives of the converts of Islam. He refrained from raising any issue likely to provoke any controversy or his adversaries to rebut his arguments. He also kept in view the fact that he and his comrades were refugees in a country, the ruler of which was a zealous Christian. His reply was the most appropriate for the occasion and showed his insight into human psychology. His speech also furnished an example of his sparkling wit, his eloquent speech, wisdom, and forcefulness, for which the Quraysh amongst the Arabs and Banu Hashim in the Quraysh were rightfully celebrated. Hani. She was the daughter of Abu Talib and cousin sister of the Prophet, whose name has been reported by some as Fakhta, Fatima, or Hind, although the name first mentioned is more familiar. She was married to Hubariya bin Aid al-Makhzumi. Once the Prophet was said alluding to her, "Of all the women who ride camels, the women of Quraysh are better, and they are more kindly to their children." Abu Umar also related that Hubariya fled to Najran after the conquest of Makkah, where he composed verses giving reasons for leaving Makkah. He indited a few verses on receiving the news of Hani's acceptance of Islam. His son from Hani was Amr, after whom was he called Abu Amr. On the day of Makkah was conquered, Hani had given protection to two persons of Banu Makhzum, whom Ali had sworn to kill wherever he found them. When the Prophet came, he greeted her, and she told him about the people she had given protection to. He replied, "We give protection to whomever you give protection, and we give safety to those who you protect. We shall not kill them." Hani says the Prophet took bath in her house and offered 8 rakat of prayers. Several hadiths related to Hani are included in the Siha Sita and other words of Hadith. Tirmidhi also reports that she was alive when Ali died. Jumana. A daughter of Abu Talib reports Abu Ahmad al-Askari, wife of Abu Sufyan al-Harith bin Abdul Muttalib and mother of Abdullah. Dar Qatani gives no more details in the Kitab al Ukhwali about her, except that she married Abu Sufyan and that Abdullah was born to her. Zubair bin Bakr says that Jumana was the sister of Hani. Ibn Ishaq says that Jumana was one of those who received 30 dasaqs from the booty of Khaybar. Al-Faqihi Kitabi Makkah reports from Abdullah bin Usman bin Jasham that he told Ata Mujahid ibn Qasir and several other persons that they used to put on ihram in the tents of Jumana at Taiman on the 27th of Ramadan. She was the daughter of Abu Talib and the mother of Jafar bin Abu Sufyan bin al-Harith, who had given 30 dasaqs from the booty of Khaybar by the Prophet. The birth of Ali bin Abu Talib. There are several authentic reports which establish that Ali bin Abu Talib was born 10 years before the Prophet received his first revelation. Ibn Sa'd says that Ali was born after 12 nights of the month of Rajab, had elapsed in the 30th year of the elephant. Hakim writes that there are consecutive reports to show that Ali was born to Fatima bint Usayd within the Kaaba. Another man born in the Kaaba was Hakim bin Hizam. Ibn Abi al-Hadid writes in his book, "There is a difference of opinion about the place where Ali was born. Most of the Shia believe that Ali was born within the Kaaba, but the scholars of Hadith do not accept this view. They are of the opinion that Hakim bin Hizam bin Khuwailid bin Asad bin Abdul Izza bin Qusay was born inside the Kaaba." Ali under the guardianship of the Prophet. Tabri has related from Mujahid that an extraordinary blessing God had destined for Ali was brought about by the grievous famine that overtook the Quraysh. Abu Talib had a very large family. The Prophet said to his uncle Abbas, who was a prosperous man among the Quraysh, "Uncle, your brother has a very large family, and you know the difficulties being faced by him. Let us relieve him of his burden and take the responsibility of supporting some of his children." Abbas agreed to this suggestion, and they both approached Abu Talib. They said, "We have come to you because in these days of distress through which all of us are passing, let us take the responsibility of some of your children and relieve you of the burden until the conditions improve." Abu Talib replied, "Do as you like as long as you leave me Aqil." Thus, the Prophet took Ali bin Abu Talib and kept him with him, and Abbas took Ja'far bin Abu Talib. Ali continued to live with the Prophet until God raised him to apostleship. Ali relied on the Prophet and affirmed his truth, while Ja'far remained with Abbas until he did not need the latter's support. Ali accepts Islam. One day, Ali came in while the Prophet and Khadija were offering prayers. Ali asked, "What is this?" The Prophet replied, "This is the religion of God, which He has chosen for Himself and sent apostles with it. I call you to God, the One, without any associates." Ali said, "It is something I have never heard before. I cannot decide until I've talked to Abu Talib about it." As the Prophet did not want the secret to be divulged before he preached Islam publicly, he said to Ali, "If you do not accept Islam, then keep it secret." Ali kept quiet for the night, and Allah implanted Islam in the heart of Ali. Early next morning, he went to the Prophet and said, "What had you told me yesterday?" The Prophet said, "Bear witness that there is no God but Allah alone, without associates, and disavow Lat and Uzza, and renounce all partners of God." Ali repeated what the Prophet had said and became Muslim. He used to come to the Prophet during the absence of Abu Talib and concealed his faith as was directed by the Prophet. These reports established that Ali was the next Muslim after Khadija to believe in Islam and the first male to offer prayers behind the Prophet. Zaid bin Arqam says that Ali was the first to believe in the divine message, while Abdullah ibn Abbas relates that the first man who accepted Islam after Khadija was Ali. Muhammad bin Abdul Rahman Zarrara says that Ali accepted Islam at the age of 9 years, but Mujahid asserts that the first man who offered prayers with the Prophet was Ali and that he was 10 years of age. Hassan bin Zayd maintains that Ali never worshipped idols since he was a child. That's when he accepted Islam. It can be assumed from the foregoing reports as well as the circumstances that since Ali passed into adolescence under the care of the Prophet and received the guidance and training of one who is destined to become the teacher of humanity, whose message was to encompass the whole world, it is unlikely that Ali would take part in anything except that is righteous. Some scholars have attempted to integrate these reports by putting forth the view that Khadija was the first woman, Abu Bakr among the first men and matured males, and Ali amongst the youngsters who were the first to accept Islam. However, the speech delivered by Ali after the death of Abu Bakr, cited elsewhere, shows that Abu Bakr was the first to accept Islam. Ali and Abu Talib. Ibn Ishaq relates that at the time of the prayers, the Prophet used to go to the glens of Makkah accompanied by Ali, who went unknown to Abu Talib, his uncles and other family members. They used to pray and return at night. This went on for as long as God had intended. One day, Abu Talib saw them while they were praying and asked the Prophet, "Oh my nephew, what is this religion I see you practicing?" He replied, "Oh uncle, this is the religion of God, His angels, His prophets, and the religion of our father Ibrahim." According to another version, the Prophet replied, "God has sent me as a prophet to mankind, and you, my uncle, most deserve that I should call you to it." Abu Talib replied, "I cannot give up the religion of my forefathers and their rules and customs, but by God, you shall never be put to any harm as long as I live." Biographers of the Prophet also relate that Abu Talib asked Ali, quote, O son, what is this religion of yours? He replied, quote, I believe in God and his Prophet, and pray with the Prophet of God, and I follow him. It is claimed that Abu Talib said to Ali, he must be calling you to what is good, so stick to the Prophet. Assistance to seekers after the truth. Ali bin Abu Talib used to guide and help those who came to Makkah in search of the truth and know more about Islam. He had been endowed with intelligence and skill expected of Banu Hashim for performing delicate jobs. The incident relating to Abu Dharr al-Ghafari, acceptance of Islam, has been narrated by Bukhari from Abdullah ibn Abbas. He writes, quote, When Abu Dharr came to know of the Prophet's mission, he sent for his brother and said, Go to the valley and find out about the man who called himself a prophet of God and believes that he receives divine communication from the heavens. Listen to him and tell me about him. Abu Dharr's brother went to the prophet and listened to him and went back. He said to Abu Dharr, I have seen him. He teaches righteous behavior and he recites something which is not poetry. Abu Dharr replied, You have not been able to tell me what I wanted. Abu Dharr then made preparations to the journey and, taking a small skin of water, set out to Makkah. He came to the sanctuary and tried to find out who the Prophet was, as he did not know him until it was dark. He lay down to sleep. Ali saw him and presumed he was a traveler. He followed him, but none addressed the other until it was morning. Abu Dharr came to the sanctuary with his belongings and spent the whole night, a whole day there, and did not meet the Prophet. It was nightfall again, and Abu Dharr lay down. Ali went near him and said, Has the man not found his destination to stay there? Ali then asked Abu Dharr to follow him, but none would speak to the other. The third day passed away in the same way. Ali, however, tarried there, and at last said to Abu Dharr, Will you tell me why you have come here? Abu Dharr replied, I will tell you if you take the pledge to guide me. Ali gave the assurance and asked him what he wanted. Abu Dharr told him of his quest, to which Ali replied, Surely the Prophet calls you to the truth. Undoubtedly he is the Prophet of God. When you rise up in the morning, come behind me. If I perceive any danger, I will halt as for a while, as if to urinate. But if I continue walking, follow me wherever I go. Abu Dharr did as directed by Ali and came to the Prophet following him. He listened to the Prophet and accepted Islam at once at the same place. The greatest honor of Ali. Ali relates, one day, I and the Prophet came out of the house and came to the doors of the Kaaba. The Prophet asked me to sit down and, clambering my shoulders, asked me to stand up. Then, realizing my feebleness, he asked me to sit down. He dismounted and himself sat down, asking me to climb over his shoulders. I did as he directed, and then he stood up until I found myself raised so high as if I would touch the sky. Thus, I reached the ceiling of the Kaaba. I started twisting the idols of copper and bronze left and right, up and down, until I was able to dislodge it. The Prophet asked me to throw it down, and when I did so, it broke into pieces as if it was made of glass. Then I dismounted and we came out quickly and hastened to our houses, lest somebody might see us. Hakim has specified in the Mustadrak that the incident relates to the period before Hijrah, or the migration. Migration. The Prophet continued to call the Quraysh and other tribes to Islam, and the animosity and bitterness of the Quraysh went on increasing. Events followed in quick succession. The boycott of Banu Hashim was enforced. They took shelter in the glen of Abu Talib. Ja'far bin Abu Talib and a number of Muslims had migrated to Abyssinia. The Prophet went to Taif, where he was mocked and ill-treated. The Prophet's accession to the heavens occurred in the meantime. Hamza bin Abdul Muttalib and Umar ibn al-Khattab accepted Islam. A number of people belonging to Makkah and those coming from outside joined to the faith of Islam. The Prophet's protector, his uncle Abu Talib, and his wife Khadija died, and the persecution of the Muslims became much more severe. Then Islam started making headways in two major types of Qahtan, that is Al-Aws and Al-Khazraj, which was followed by the two pledges of Aqaba. Islam spread quickly in Medina, and Muslims started migrating to that city until only the Prophet, Ali, Abu Bakr, and a few other Muslims who had been forcibly detained remained in Makkah. The Quraysh feared that the Prophet might also go and leave and get out of their reach. These incidents require a detailed description, but need not be recounted in the biography of Ali, for they form a part of the biography of the Prophet. Such were the conditions when Quraysh assembled in Dar al-Nadwa, their council chamber, and agreed on suggestion that each clan should provide a young man, powerful, courageous, who should all strike a blow at the Prophet jointly and kill him. Thus the responsibility of his blood would be upon all clans, and Abdu Manaf, not being able to fight all of them together, would accept blood money. Having come to the decision, the people dispersed. Allah informed the Prophet about this decision. The Prophet told to Ali to lie on his bed, saying that no harm would come to him. It was certainly not an easy task, for anyone in place of Ali would have been to take a nap on that bed. It was only possible for a man having unflinching faith in God and so smitten by the love of the Prophet that he was willing to lay down his life for him. And all this was true of Ali, for he must have thought that when the enemy would come to know that the Prophet had escaped, they would all fall upon him. But Ali, absolutely unconcerned about his own safety, lay down and had a sound sleep on the Prophet's bed. The enemy assembled at the door of the Prophet, determined to strike him at once. When he came out, the Prophet came out of them with a handful of dust. God took away their sight so that they could not see him, and he began to sprinkle dust in their heads as he recited the first 9 verses of Surah Yasin, ending with the words, "And we covered them and they could not see." When the Prophet left, someone came up and asked the disbelievers what they were waiting for. Then they said that they were waiting for Muhammad. He said, "But by good heavens, Muhammad is gone." Then the people peeped inside and saw Ali lying on the bed of the Prophet. They were assured that the Prophet was still there. They remained there until morning, when Ali rose from his bed and they had to return frustrated in their task. Ibn Sa'd relates that from Ali, quote, "When the Prophet went to Medina with the intention of migration to the city, he commanded me to stay behind in Makkah in order to return the goods which men had deposited with him to their owners." People used to deposit their goods with the Prophet, for they knew him to be Amin, or trustworthy. Ali further says, "I stayed for 3 days after the departure of the Prophet. I mixed with people and did not withdraw even for a day. Then after 3 days, I went to the locality of Amr bin Auf. The Prophet was present there. I went to the house of Kulsum bin al-Hidham, where the Prophet was staying." Ali traveled by night and kept himself concealed during the day throughout the journey. When he reached Medina, he had blisters on his feet. The Prophet sent for Ali. When he was informed that Ali was unable to walk, to the Prophet himself went to Ali. He embraced Ali, saw the sores in his feet, and shed tears. The Prophet applied his saliva on the wounds and passed his hands on Ali's legs. Ali never had trouble with his legs till the time of his death. Ali arrived in Medina in mid-Rabi al-Awwal. The Prophet had not left Quba by that time. A report in Sunan of Tirmidhi shows that at Medina the Prophet took Ali as his own brother. Apart from Tirmidhi, who holds the report as authentic, Shah Waliullah has given preference to it in both of his books. Jazakallah khair. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.